Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm going to apologize for the delay in dropping this episode, but I got back from a working gig, a contract gig, and was a little under the weather. So I decided to take a few days to get back in tip-top shape. And so I'm dropping this podcast on a Tuesday instead of last Sunday. All those excuses aside, I am very excited to introduce my guest this week, Chip Scholes. And besides for discovering that we kind of have lived in the same little patch of the world, Chip is someone who personifies resilience, strength, and coming back from something that might seem insurmountable at first glance. But a little bit about Chip, who is, among many other things, an executive coach, author, storyteller, and student of handoffs, which is the moment you understand that responsibility, identity, leadership, and eventually legacy pass from one person to another. We talk about when he experienced his stroke and what it looked like to emerge from that and heal from that. But we also talk about how a layoff later in life gave him an unexpected reset. We also happily talk about woodworking, and I discuss how I was absolutely terrified by the lathe in eighth grade shop class, but Chip talks about it, talks me down, and helps me to understand that woodworking has helped change his life. So now, woodworking fears aside, here's my very next episode of the podcast.
I can point to seeing a ghost when I was in the fraternity house years ago, and alcohol was not involved. We had an old house that was built on another foundation from a house that was an orphanage that burned down, and so some of the kids were still there, and you ran into them every once in a while.
Get on a stage, if you had to present to, let's say, 500 people, and you had to introduce yourself to them, how would you do that?
Eternally curious. The thought on most people's part is to introduce themselves with all of the things they've done. And it really doesn't get to the heart of humanity. It doesn't get to the heart of who you are, because you're not a sum of all the things you've done. There are things that you've done that you're proud of, and I'm certainly I've written a bunch of books, and I'm certainly proud of that. Does that make me an author? Well, I don't know. I think it's just I'm eternally curious. And I think that's what keeps me going, is that curiosity.
I think curiosity is a superpower. Personally, would you say that? I would suspect you've been curious since you were a kid. Is that true?
I don't know. I probably have gotten a lot more curious as I've gotten older. You know, one of the things about being a coach is that you have to ask questions. Well, to ask questions, you have to be curious. And so, I used to call myself back in the day, I used to call myself a collector of people. How some people collect stamps or, gewgaws or anything like that. And I used to call myself a collector of people, but I don't see myself as much at that. I just find myself as somebody who is curious about things and ask great questions. And that's pretty much what I do. The other thing is, I have a phrase that I use a lot is Semper Gumby. And Semper Gumby, Semper is always, Gumby. You know who Gumby is, right?
Yes.
That's Gumby. And I keep him on my desk, and I always remind myself, you know, so it's always flexible. And that's what Semper Gumby is. And it's funny, I teach a bunch of classes, facilitate with a couple of colleagues. And when I got this one new colleague, she was very regimented and everything had to be on a timeline and everything was written out in a script. And I said, you can't facilitate that way. You got to facilitate Semper Gumby because there's some things that are going to go quick. And you're all of a sudden standing there with nothing to do, or there are some things that are going to go extremely slow. And then like half the content you're not going to get to. And so, you know, it's, you got to be flexible and you got to be curious.
I like that. Semper Gumby. I think you just found the title of the podcast episode, to be honest.
Okay.
You had me, I have to say, before we started recording, we were talking about being from the same little patch of the woods in yes. Illinois. And the fact that you use the word gigas just has like melted my heart because it's one of my favorite, like it's one of my favorite phrases, words, and very few people know it, but it's just emblematic of another time when words were meant something else. And these interesting, it's very, I've used those words before and someone has said, what does that mean? So the fact that you used it, I'm now eternally grateful to you.
And we call those tchotchkes now.
Tchotchkes, yes. let me ask you, when you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming?
You know, I always wanted to be a professional golfer. But we actually, come on. I always wanted to be my dad. You know, I had a great dad who taught me a lot of things. He was a professional salesman and spent most of his life in sales. I always saw myself following in his footsteps. Yeah, I always wanted to be a professional golfer, but I was not that good, and I didn't have the work ethic to be able to be that good. And especially when you grow up in the Midwest, you know, if you grow up in the South or Texas or California, hey, playing year round is a whole lot easier and a whole lot better than just playing or playing, you know, the 3 months that are the summer. But you know, really, I just always wanted to be my dad, and so that's how I started out. You know, my first job out of school was being a salesman. I did a lot of sales in high school and college. I was always working. I mean, I had two or three jobs all the time when I was in high school and college, and so you know that's what I came in with. And yeah, slowly but surely, my ideas of that changed, and so that's why I became an executive coach about 27 years ago.
Yeah, I think, was your dad a golfer, by the way?
Oh God, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He always thought he was Jack Nicklaus because he looked a lot like Jack Nicklaus. You know, he had blonde hair and you know, he was similar body style and that kind of thing. But he always thought he was Jack Nicklaus. And he was a hell of a golfer.
He was good.
Yeah, he was. He was.
I, in high school, I worked for a somewhat swanky, pretty new, country club golf resort outside of St. Charles. And, you know, the kind of place where you had to buy a house on the course to be able to play there. And, I was the beverage cart girl. So I drove around with a beverage cart and served drinks to the golfers, which was like a pretty cool, gig. I met what's his name from Laughing, Artie, someone, I can't remember his name.
Artie Johnson.
Yes. And he was a peach, as we say in the Midwest. He was really wonderful. But it was, you know, I forget what day it was, but there was one day where they closed down the course for half a day for the staff to golf. I was terrible, terrible. But I just
remember, you had a good time, right?
Right, right. I mean, I loved just the whole walking part of it and the silence and just going from hole to hole, maybe with a couple of friends,
for me, it was, I loved it because it was also beautiful. Like the course was gorgeous and lots of trees and green. And I've always loved the color green. I knew that I was a terrible golfer. It was never going to be my thing, but there was something just really profound for me walking through that course really slowly, which I feel like is part of playing golf. Do you think so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, there's a great book by, I think it was John Feinstein that wrote A Good Walk Spoiled. they call golf A Good Walk Spoiled.
That's actually completely hilarious. And yeah, I mean, the fact that human beings can actually get this small, tiny ball into a hole, you know, that sometimes you're like, where's the hole? I know you have the flag, but you can see it and it's like so far away, is astonishing to me.
After the pod, Google Robin Williams golf. And he does this whole thing in a Scottish accent. And he talks about the origin of golf. And he says, and he uses, you know, some salty language and that, but he talks about, you know, you've got to hit it 400 yards into this little hole and you're doing it 18 times. You know, it's hilarious. If you ever get a chance to, it's worth the watch.
Oh, I bet. I love Robin Williams. He's like one of my favorites. So yeah. I will take you up on that.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, now, when I was at Batavia, they had shop class, okay? Mm-hmm. And in seventh grade, you made a clipboard out of wood. In eighth grade, they allowed you to pick something. You could make whatever you wanted. And foolish me, because I didn't quite know what I was getting into, I decided to make a checkers board with checkers. And everything went well until I had to use the lathe, which scared me. I mean, I just could not believe something could turn that fast. And then I had to use this really sharp implement that also scared me to, you know, make the checkers, to whittle down the wood or to whatever. Anyway, I love that you're like here in your profile, you're like, you found yourself standing at a wood lathe learning to turn bowls. And I just have to tell you that I had a flashback and then I started, you know, I was like, okay, breathe. Cause it took me right back to making those checkers pieces. But I mean, it sounds like you had none of those problems. This wood turning thing is fascinating to me.
Well, you know, so I was recovering from a stroke and my wife bought me a lathe for Christmas. And the last time I had used the lathe was in seventh grade, you know, and it was shop class. And I still have the candle holders that I did in shop class, which, you know, were really crummy. And yeah, anyway, but, you know, you got to use a drill press and you got to use all that stuff. And it was a lot of fun. So, I had done a lot of woodworking over the years. I'd made a lot of furniture and not a lot, but, you know, a couple of entertainment centers when entertainment centers were a big thing, and desks and that kind of thing. But something about the lathe, you know, and, you know, here's the thing that most people don't understand is, why do we like the green environment? Well, we like the green environment because there's no square corners in nature.
Yeah.
And so the roundness of the leaves, I'm looking out right now, outside, the roundness of the leaves, the shapes that you find in nature, the pebbles in a stream, the stream itself, there are no square corners. And according to a lot of the research that's been done, the round corners actually relax your mind. And so we love to take walks outside because it relaxes our mind. When we get into the built environment, obviously everything is all square because that's kind of the way we all came up, that we have to have square corners in a built environment. And it's stressful. And so I don't think there's anything you can do on the lathe. You can make a square bowl, but there's still round corners. There's still radius that is involved in that. But you know, if you look at the stuff that's behind me, all the wood stuff it's round.
Yeah.
And so it just is extremely relaxing to turn something square into something round. And so, you know, I took to it pretty quickly. I started off with what they call carbide tools, which are more of a scraper. But I graduated to those sharp implements that are tools now. I never saw it as scary. Now, I will say that I had a friend of mine that was pretty badly injured when a bowl blew up. Yeah, it took a 3-inch, a bowl blew up on him, and he was doing some things that were not really smart. It took a 3-inch chunk out of his skull, and 11 operations, and 7 years later, he's good. But, he was doing some things that were patently unsafe, and he got away with them for a long time before that. So, you know, you just think you're going to get away with things like that. Never really had any safety instruction or that kind of thing. But, you know, if you're operating the lathe in a safe manner and you're doing things that aren't stupid, you're more likely to walk away.
Words to live by.
Yes. Don't do anything stupid.
So I'm curious, just like you, when you had your stroke, did they say, you know, was one of the prescriptions for you to get better to find a new avocation or a new hobby or to learn something new?
No, my doctor, in fact, was not not really encouraging. So, I had some deficits after the stroke. I had a hard time talking. I'm a little bit of slurring words, a little bit hard, aphasia, which is you can't find words. And I was paralyzed and all that kind of stuff. So I was better after about 3 months. And I went in to see him and he said, I think you got all you're going to get. That was not acceptable to me. If I'd only come back 3 months after the stroke and that was my steady state from there on, that would have not been okay. My life would have changed in many, many ways. As it was, my life changed in a lot of ways, but they're self-imposed changes rather than changes to my physicality and my mental state. But the delay got my cognition back where it used to, where it needed to be. And maybe it's the new hand-eye coordination, but I was never told to go do something else. It's just something that, you know, again, my wife gave me a lathe and it's like, okay, I loved it.
It's like she knows you or something.
Well, you know, you've been married long enough. Yeah. They probably should.
Yes, one would hope.
Yes.
I would love to ask you the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? You know, if so, what did that look like? And then, you know, do you have a connection even now to something outside yourself? And how has that evolved over time?
That's a great question. And you're a doctor of divinity, right? You went to seminary?
Yeah, master's
okay.
of divinity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so that's a great question. So let me ask you, what is your belief?
Well, I obviously grew up overseas, in Guyana and South America and then in Pakistan. But, you know, in the midst of all of that, I traveled all over the world, everywhere, Bangkok, Bangladesh, I mean, you name it, I've been there probably. And so as a kid, I was just also the American school in Pakistan, kids from all over the world, every country, every religion, every food. And so it just, you know, growing up all over the world and experiencing that just complexity and diversity of all of it, of culture, religion, food, just that's what whetted my curiosity. That is what made me want to learn more about everything in the world. I'm eternally captivated by how humans create meaning through experience or through mm-hmm. cultural stories. And so, you know, I was like a Christian for a while, and then I was an atheist, and now I've settled on panentheist, which means that I believe that the world, it's kind of like an animist. So I believe that everything is sacred, everything is holy, that everything wants to communicate with us, that it has, you know, a consciousness of its own that maybe we can't understand it, but it still exists in its perfection and beauty. You know, one of these days I would love to learn to talk to a tree and have a conversation, but that day hasn't arrived yet. You know, maybe they could give me some tips on the golf course. You know, you never know. They're watching these golfers go by. So that's where I live in an intelligent universe, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, my mother was Episcopalian. My father was Lutheran.
Okay.
Which is, you know, kind of like backdoor Catholic for both of those. Lutheran, obviously, more of a Germanic, you know, coming down from Martin Luther. And my mother was Episcopalian, which is kind of like Catholic light. They become Episcopalians because Henry VIII didn't like Catholicism. You know, we became Methodists because that's what they could agree on. So I grew up in a religious household, not religious, like, hey, we were praying every 5 minutes or that, but it was always present. I was confirmed. I was baptized. I was doing, you know, all that kind of stuff. It was funny in college. I actually started to evangelize at first year, actually in high school and part of college, because Wheaton, Illinois, as you well know, is the home of Wheaton College.
Yes.
And Wheaton College is the alma mater of Billy Graham. And you know, you couldn't make love standing up because it was too much like dancing.
Oh, dear.
I thought you would appreciate that one. Yeah. And so, you know, Wheaton was a dry town for many years. In fact, I think it only went wet like 10 or 15 years ago. And it was so bizarre because I was in Wheaton for a reunion. And I went to the Wheaton Beer Festival, which was just such a crazy juxtaposition. But it was dry for many years. You could go across the border to Glen Ellen and buy booze, but you couldn't buy it in Wheaton. And so, you know, when I was growing up, I think there were 47 churches and 20,000 people. It was crazy. And just about every denomination you could possibly imagine, you know, and some denominations you can't even imagine. But that was how I grew up. I ended up with a bunch of people that were, you know, were friends, and ended up at the Presbyterian Church with Dr. Clarence Lauer, who was an old Scotsman from way back. I mean, God, Clarence was to an 18-year-old. I'm sure he seemed like he was about 140 years old, but he probably wasn't. But he was a great old sermon giver. He would lean up against the side of the pulpit and he'd put his hand up here and he'd start to talk about this, and all in a Scottish brogue. It was pretty incredible. So I hung around with a lot of religious people. In fact, I went to Illinois Wesleyan in Bloomington, Illinois, as a pre-theological.
Oh,
so I had fully intended on being a minister, and then I found women and booze, and you know, that kind of all derailed. But anyway, you know, and I see what I do now as an extension of that. You know, it may not be religious, but it is spiritual. you know, because I help people be the best they can be. And what is a higher calling than that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you're lifting them up. You're helping them to see who they actually are. And a lot of people get so caught up in their own kind of like internal stories that they can't see a way out of them. It's actually quite fascinating. I've been talking about this with a couple friends. You know, we all have our ideas of who we are, but then if you ask a friend, hey, you know, who do you think I am? They'll have a totally different view of you. And I think it would behoove us to listen to that, because they might see something that we don't see that we can then live into. That's why I think it's really good to have either good friends or a coach or, you know, maybe even a boss who's worked with you for a while to, you know, just reflect back to you what they,
you know, that I'll tell you there's a big thing with coaching. And the thing that I love about coaching is that I'm not trying to give you advice. I'm not trying to implant a belief on you. It is strictly about asking questions. It is strictly about helping you to figure out your own stuff. And it's differing than from therapy, in that therapy is thinking more about what your past is like. You know, and as a coach, I don't care how your relationship with your mother was. I care about, okay, so what are you going to do about it? What's going to come in the future? You know, if you want to get here, how are you going to do it? And I found over the years, especially, that advice is a trap, because if I give you advice and you take it and it doesn't work out, who are you going to blame? You're going to blame me, right? Yeah. So, you know, even as the advice giver, then it doesn't work out well for me. And if you don't take the advice, then I kind of wonder, okay, why didn't you take that advice? It's obviously, you know, it's clear. And that kind of goes to the uniqueness of all humans, right? You know, you and I have similarities in what we've done in our lived experience, but you and I have completely different lived experiences.
Yeah.
And I found that even people growing up in the same household can have completely different lived experience. My brother has spent 30 years in China. And so, you know, he has a completely different lived experience than I have. And we grew up in the same house, but we have two different ways of looking at the world, two different ways of seeing things, two different ways of talking about our world. And I have no more business in giving him advice than he does in me. You know, so I can ask him some great questions and listen to his answers, but I'm not going to give him advice.
Yeah. 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 Wow. China. And for so long, I can't even imagine that.
Yep.
Wow. What an adventure. You know, one of the things I try to remember is that every morning when I wake up, I have no idea what the day is going to bring. It could bring some sort of experience that is completely astonishing and will change everything. And that life, you know, should be lived or viewed as an adventure. You know, obviously I grew up overseas. So whenever anybody leaves the culture that they grew up in and goes somewhere else and has this experience, it's always fascinating to me. How many siblings did you have, by the way?
Just one.
Just one. Okay.
Just one brother.
And is he older or younger than you?
Younger.
Younger. Okay.
5 years younger.
Okay. Okay. So you were able to give him plenty of noogies when you were growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a great job of beating him up all the time.
Isn't that what an older brother is supposed to do? I think, I mean, that's what I've heard.
Well, in one particular case, I put his head through the bathroom door. And so it was right around Christmas, and my mother wanted to make sure my father didn't get really hot when he came home about the bathroom door being stove in. And so she hung a Christmas picture over the hole and waited until Dad had his second Manhattan and then told him about it. But yeah.
Okay.
We were wrestling as usual. So, you know, and I just, I put his head through the door.
Is your mom brilliant or am I just imagining that?
She knew my dad.
I'm just, wow. I would have never thought of that solution. That's actually kind of incredible. Wow. How brilliant. I think you know, now I might have another solution for anything that comes my way that looks like that. Thank you.
Well, there we go. Yes. There we go. Yeah, my dad and mom were pretty cool people. My dad died at 51. My mom died at 56. And so I was an orphan at 30 years old. And, that's pretty formative, too.
I would say was my grandfather was a salesman, but his job actually took him. He had to drive around, drive from state to state and was kind of this roguish, peripatetic sort of like salesman on the move. Did your dad, was he out on the road as well?
Yeah, younger. He worked for General Electric. He worked for Hardy Salt, selling salt industrially and then went for General Electric and sold for them for a long time. Then he ended up with a company called Indiana Glass that made decorative glassware. And he was a regional sales manager for them. So he had the whole Midwest, he could be in Minneapolis or St. Louis or whatever. And so he did a lot of flying in that. Sometimes he drove, but most of the time it was flying.
I mean, talk about a way of life that doesn't exist anymore. You know, the traveling salesman.
It still exists.
It does.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah. It still exists.
Right. Mostly flying.
No, there are people that, and I know a lot of industrial sales people, forklift sales reps, that kind of thing that have a state or two territory and they drive everywhere they go.
Oh. Okay. See, and I've learned multiple things from you today. How to cover up a hole in something, if you don't want anybody to see it, about traveling salesmen. I've learned about golf. I do have to tell you, just going back to I have a really soft spot in my heart for the Episcopal Church. I think it is incredibly beautiful. I love their liturgies. I used to date a gentleman, whenever we travel and go vacation, we would visit different churches because we were both so enamored of those spaces and places and meeting the congregations. And Episcopalians were always, always friendly, welcoming, effusive, just generous of spirit. It just felt like coming home every time I walked into an Episcopal church. So,
I married an Episcopalian. So, I've been surrounded by it most of my life.
Yes. See, we both have great taste.
Okay.
I'd love to ask you the main question of the podcast, which is, I would so appreciate if you would share, it can be one story, it can be two stories, where maybe you either witnessed or experienced something you thought was magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
It's funny. I've been thinking about that and how to answer that. And I think just about everything is magical, mysterious, or, I really think life is, I can point to seeing a ghost when I was in the fraternity house years ago, and alcohol was not involved. We had an old house that was built on another foundation from a house that it was an orphanage that burned down. And so some of the kids were still there, and you ran into them every once in a while.
Was that in Illinois?
Bloomington, Illinois. Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. The fraternity house has been torn down. It's a parking lot for a hospital now. But, at one time, that's the way it was. There's been so many things over the years, I think my favorite story is I was getting the business started, and I was running out of money pretty quick. And I'd been working hard to try to get business on board and get the business started. And I was at a gas station one evening, and I just looked up and I said, God, can you help me? I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I think I've been doing everything right. I'm doing all the calls. I'm doing what I think I should be doing. And I said, just give me a sign that I'm going the right direction. And, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel instead of an oncoming train. And, about that time, some guy stuck his head around the pump, and it was a guy that I've been trying to get to see for 6 months. And, he poked his head around the corner. He was a city manager of the town that I lived in. And he said, Chip, is that you? And I said, yeah. And he said, he made some offhand comment about paying for his gas, because I lived in the same town that he was city manager of. And it's like, already I'm paying so many taxes that I'm already paying your gas. But anyway, he said, I know you've been trying to get in touch with me. He said, can you be in my office in the next day or two? And I'd like to talk to you about what we can do together. And a couple of days later, a guy that I had known, one of the first people I did business with, called and said, hey, that thing you did, can you help this office out? And can you help this office out? And then another guy called. It's funny because this person has been in my life for 25 years. He's still a big part of what I do. And he's with another company now. But, at the time he was running his own thing, and he said, hey, listen, I can't tell you what it's about yet, but I'll give you a call. I've got this company I'm going with, and I know they need what you have. And it was, it was just like the switch turned on, and instead of going and finding a job or doing something else, it just started to happen. So,
wow. And who would have thought that it would have happened at the gas pump? I mean, it can happen anywhere.
It can happen anywhere. Yeah. You don't have to be in a church. You don't have to be sitting in a pew. You don't have to be kneeling. I have a different view of religion, and my view of religion is, it's not the punitive God hates me and is going to punish me kind of view. It's the, why would he be like that? I mean, that's the Old Testament God. And, yeah. And when you look at Jesus and what Jesus said, he preached love. He didn't preach eternal damnation. And, the more you read about the early church, the more you find out that the reason that they started preaching eternal damnation and hellfire was to put butts in seats. And because of this, if they could scare you like crazy, and the way of salvation was to come and sit in church, well, then you were going to come and sit in church. I don't believe that. I think that, God wants the best for me. And, I'm not always the best. I do stupid things. I certainly what would be called wicked things at times, but I think they all got accounted for that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Really beautifully stated, by the way. It's so clear to me through this conversation that you are someone, and maybe this was hard won or hard fought, but you just seem or appear to be someone who's kind of unstoppable, frankly, and optimistic, but also really you carry a positivity about you that probably, you know, brushes off on everyone around you, which is something that we need in this world. Now, can I ask you, this is how I see you. Do you think this is your essential nature? Is this how you've always been? And then, of course, I've never had a stroke, but coming back from a stroke is no joke. But I think it helps if you have an unstoppable spirit and you have optimism. And so I'm wondering if those traits inside of you helped you to heal.
There's a great book called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And if you ever get a chance to read it, and it talks about the two mountains we climb. And the first mountain is, you know, money and fame and all that kind of stuff. And then somewhere along the line, you have a crisis. You know, could have been, I got laid off in May of 98. And we changed our life considerably. We moved from LA to North Carolina. We opened businesses and all that kind of stuff. So maybe that was maybe that was one of the mountains, or maybe the health crisis was a mountain. But the second mountain is about meaning and purpose. And some people never go through that valley, never have that crisis. If you do go through that, if you do have that issue, how do you come out on the other side? And the other side is meaning and purpose. It's similar to retirement. You know, I don't ever see myself retiring, but the next stage is depression, because it's like, I don't have to do anything. And you've lost your identity. So anyway, and then there's third stage is meaning and purpose. Well, you know, I mean, you've got to go through some kind of fire to have meaning and purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. You know, I've had conversations with people who've retired, and, you know, funnily enough, so many of them say, I am busier now than I was before I was working and trying to live a life. And I think that's because they've discovered that to, you know, lift themselves up, being busy, contributing, having a hobby, participating in community, it kind of snowballs. And it's kind of like the gift we give ourselves after we retire. I have to say that, I mean, obviously you're not retired. You're just like out there blazing a path for the rest of us. Which can be exhausting, but also really, I don't know, nurturing. Or nourishing, I guess, is what I want to say, because, you know, you can see your work in action as your clients go out into the world and become their better selves, you know, step into their purpose. I mean, is that partially why you do it? It must be so inspiring to witness that.
That is why I do it.
Yeah.
You know? And it kind of goes to my purpose. And my purpose is I live to develop people. So that's what I do all day long. And it doesn't matter whether it's wood turning. I'm the president of the North Carolina Woodturners Association. I teach wood turning on the weekends, and you know, it's not about the you know, me being the best turner that I can possibly be, but it's helping people to be the best they can be. And so, you know, part of that is people. I'm a people too. So I have to be the best that I can be so I can help others be the best they can be, because I can't give what I don't have. You know, and what I mean by that is that if I've got no fuel in the tank, then I'm going to be hard pressed to move anybody else.
I think, Chip, that you just dropped the mic and walked away. Has anyone ever said that to you before?
No, but thank you. Thank you.
that's it, a wrap on my conversation with Chip. If you'd like to discover a little bit more about this man and the work that he's doing in the world, woodworking and all, follow the links in the episode's show notes. And then do a deeper dive on what this incredible legacy maker is doing. I'm so grateful to Chip for sharing all his stories, for sharing about his journey, and how life's twists and turns can sometimes lead us to exactly where we need to be. I want to thank all of you for listening. This podcast makes me so happy to produce. I get to meet incredible humans like Chip, and then I get to share their stories with the world. So if you like what you're hearing, please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Chip. Don't ever give up. But also, be willing to go with those twists and turns in life. You never know when the unexpected layoff or the unexpected event is exactly what you needed to change and reorient your life. We're all looking to live rich, abundant lives. And sometimes it seems that life has other plans for us. But if we go with the flow and step back and consider, most times life deposits us exactly where we need to be so that we too can step into our own and become blessings for everyone around us.